The Reverend Malcolm McDuffie, January 15th, 1970.
Pretty well on your meter?
Yep, seems to.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about the influence of, particularly of mechanical propulsion on the shape of boat's hull. Mm-hmm. And in my memory, going back to about 1912 or 14, somewhere in there, I would be pretty reliable. The lobster boats in the Mount Desert Island area were mostly double-enders, and the folk name for them was peapod boats. Mm-hmm. The genuine peapod, of course, is a rowboat, but the peapod shape was something that was...
Can I ask a question about that?
Yes.
I've been trying to establish some possible origins for the double-ended lobster boat, which I've not been able to find really where they came from.
Mm.
Because the previous lobster boats, the sail lobster boats used previous to that time, immediately previous to that time,
yes,
were friendship sloops.
Yes, they were.
Stern,
yeah.
This kind of thing. They came from the Western. There didn't seem to be much of a sloop building tradition around here.
Mm.
The fact that they called them peapod boats makes me wonder, was this name based only on the analogy of the shape of the
I think it was based only on the analogy, because my guess is that if you will look at some literature on this subject, you'll discover that there is a family of double-enders,
mm-hmm,
sail workboats, sail-driven workboats, most characteristic of which is the Block Island boat and the No Man's Land boat.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
These taken from the Buzzards Bay area.
Yeah.
And then Isle of Shoals boat, of course. Good for you. You're aware of that.
And then
that
the Cowhorn in Long Island.
The Cowhorn in Long Island.
Yeah.
And
were these ubiquitous?
Yes.
All along the coast?
I would say so, yes.
Were they quite common after the Civil War, before 1880?
Yes, I would say that probably this double-end business would depend very largely on the kind, on whether boats had to be launched through the surf or not.
Mm-hmm.
This had an awful lot to do with it. You'll find that along the Jersey coast and in harborless islands like the big islands in Long Island Sound and Buzzards Bay area, Martha's Vineyard and so on, where they didn't have good harbors, boats had to be pulled up on the beach, dragged on what they used to call ladders.
Mm-hmm.
This type of thing. This was the area in which these double enders were first used. The mm-hmm. boats were launched near the places where the fishing was good.
Yes.
You see,
yes.
And this often was on islands or on exposed ocean beaches.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, when boats became larger and able to stay at sea longer, and perhaps didn't have to be hauled out on the beach, they resorted to bigger boats, abler boats. Then it was no longer necessary to have double-end boats. Mm-hmm. In fact, the square stern boat has, as they say, much more bearing. She's much more stable, a better sea-keeping boat.
Mm-hmm.
She'll carry her sail much longer. She'll carry more burden as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because you see, when a boat is cut away to make her a double-ender, it means that the last quarter of her or the last third of her is losing displacement quite rapidly all the time.
Yeah.
And so that the transom stern or the square stern, as it's immersed, its displacement keeps on increasing as you go down, you
mm-hmm.
see.
Mm-hmm.
And
The things such as the St. Pierre Dory with their tremendous shear.
Yeah. This has never been altogether. This is a Nova Scotian or a Newfoundland characteristic,
mm-hmm.
and it probably has something to do if you look into it carefully. I've never seen John Gardner doesn't say so. He's one of the great experts that we have on this, but he doesn't say so. But I expect this has an awful lot to do with the way they plank them. I imagine that if you started out, if you decided that you wanted a certain rocker on the keel,
mm-hmm.
and you started out with that, now that would be might be governed by the use on the beaches and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
If you started out with that and you
or
started by Huh?
For maneuverability.
Yes, for maneuverability.
Yeah.
And then you made a midship section, or shadow as they used to call them, that is one mold in the middle,
mm-hmm.
and you started planking them up with straight edge boards.
Yeah.
I suspect that you'd come out with a tremendous shear, you see.
Yeah, sure, they twisted them over and run.
Yeah, that's the way it would come out just by nature if you didn't cut them down. Now, I suspect it's more for the sake of cheap and rapid building.
Yeah.
Than it is because they either like the looks of it or because there's anything too practical about having such enormous soaring ends on them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really think there is. I don't think they need to be sprung up as high as that. I think the standard fisherman...
It has an advantage, and that is if they do run into a sea from ahead or from behind, they do rise over it.
Yes, but I don't think they need as much to make them rise over it as that, anywhere
probably,
near.
Yeah.
I would say that I never heard of any dory, the standard American dory, Banks dory, for example, which has nowhere near that amount of shear, I never heard of any of them being overwhelmed from either end.
Sure, sure.
This wasn't what happened to dories was that the crew finally became exhausted and died from exhaustion.
Mm-hmm.
The crew was unable to bail any longer, or what have you. I mean, the men failed, the boat didn't fail.
Yeah.
So they don't really need that enormous shear.
It's hard to know at what point a local aesthetic will take over.
It certainly is.
It may become its own justification.
Indeed, it very often does this with boats and with everything else too.
Yep. Houses.
boats, houses, clothing, the functional thing. People forget all about, and at last the thing carries on. It's got a momentum of its own, and it becomes, as you say, it's self-justifying. It's what people are used to.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way they've always been built. And if you talk to somebody like Bobby Rich here, boat builders, he'll tell you, if you ask him why he does a thing a certain way, he'll say, well, this is the way we've always done it. This is the way we... His father was a boat builder before him, and father did it this way.
Mm-hmm.
And he has discovered better ways of doing things, but quite often. Well, now let's get back to this business of the shapes of boats. I suspect that this double-ender thing came from the parent type, whatever it is, of double-end fishing boat that was usually rigged as some people call them the periauger rig, one mast way up in the bow and the other one for little...
Spritzel catch. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or a cat catch.
And I think probably both of those are inexact, but it's a rig all by itself. It's the no man's land rig or the Block Island rig.
Was this also that you could, in the wintertime, haul one mast and set the
forward? Yes, they had various thoughts in them. They were open boats, and they had thoughts in them with holes so that you could get various combinations of sail area and sort of balance and so on. Well, so I think the shape which became characteristic in time of these power-driven work boats, double-end work boats, was that the greatest beam was about a third the way from the stern, or two-thirds the way back from the bow. I think the reason for this was that a power-driven boat, especially a double-ender, tends to squat, settle aft.
Yeah,
well, now, by making them full aft, they tried, you see, to give them more bearing aft so that it would hold up the weight of the engines, which were aft anyhow. They seemed to want the engines as far back as they could get them, one or two. And then, to prevent squatting, they made them quite full aft. The afterbody was quite full.
You mentioned yesterday that they had two engines and the reasons for it. I wonder if you'd go into that.
Yeah. Yes. Probably the first attempt was a single engine in the center, which would be a hand-started, two-cycle, make-and-break ignition marine engine, rather heavy, probably pretty close to 100 pounds to a horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
And the horsepowers would run up to maybe much lower than today, for example, but I think you'd say that, for instance, a 22-foot boat would be around 4 horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd go up to maybe a 30-foot boat, which would probably be about the largest, might be as high as 6 or 7.
Mm-hmm. How fast does this drive them along?
This would drive the boat at hull speed, I would say. In other words, that's as fast as the hull would conveniently go or economically go.
Mm-hmm.
It's somewhere between 5 and 6 knots.
Mm-hmm.
And
what period were they doing simply one engine?
Well, the one engine, I should imagine, would begin, the period for that would begin somewhere around 1890, perhaps. Which was about the dawn of the time when fishermen began to mechanize at all, not much before that. I wouldn't say much then, but between then and 1910, somewhere in there, but it's a very rapid, once you get started on this thing, it doesn't take very long to develop, because then, as the boats, the fishermen began with very small boats, probably rowing boats, which were converted with maybe little bits of engines, 1-2 horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course,
power dories like yours, falling back.
Yeah, some of them like that. Some of them like that. Some of them they just took whatever rowboats they had, round bottom rowboats. Most of them Peapods, and adapted them, put shaft logs in them, and so forth.
Yeah.
So they.
I saw a photograph or a postcard in William Ballard's collection.
Yeah.
Showing it looked like a Whitehall boat with an
yes.
engine in it.
Yes. Oh yes.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure, they were doing this.
Boat.
They were a pulling boat, then put engines in them. Boats up maybe 14 feet long, somewhere around there, little engines. Then, I think, then they would began putting engines in the friendship sloops, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was...
Did they dismast them?
Some of them they did. Of course, here we had on Mount Desert Island, they had a closed lobster season for years and years and years, 2 months in the summertime. July and August. During that time, there were enough summer people who didn't have boats in those days, so that the fishermen, a great many of them, would clean their boats up and varnish them and paint them. They put a lot of work into them. They really made them look like yachts.
Uh-huh.
And they'd take out some sailing parties.
Well, I've seen photographs of an old friend.
Yeah.
The old boat called the Reliance?
Yes.
Used to do this
sure.
in Northeast Harbor, yeah.
Yes, there were. As a matter of fact, I would say that probably all the way around Mount Zero Island, there might have been 100 boats engaged in this sort of thing in the summertime. And then, as soon as the summer people went, right after Labor Day, many of these boats were quite promptly put back into the lobster service again. This was their real work in the wintertime. And many of them were. The masts were taken out.
Mm-hmm.
Others, the masts were left in. And I have in one of my scrapbooks somewhere a picture of a Monhegan lobsterman, which is obviously a friendship sloop, with a dory hauled up on the stern and a jib set, I believe, and motoring along in her pursuit of her profession as a lobsterman. So,
yeah.
Both ways. And quite often the sloops had two engines in them.
Mm-hmm.
So, the step from one engine to two engine was engines was simply the realization that the engine had to be stopped and started for every trap that was picked up.
Yes.
And this was these engines didn't start particularly easily. They had big cylinders, slow. They were slow speed, but they had large cylinder capacities, which meant a good deal of compression, and they were started by being pulled with a pin in the flywheel. There was a pin sticking into the flywheel, usually an oak peg, and they would rock it at the bottom of the compression and then pull up against the compression until a latch snapped on an eccentric mechanism. This snapping of this latch ignited a spark inside the cylinder. It was all done mechanically. There wasn't any spark plug, but there was actually 2 points inside the cylinder that sparked when they touched.
Yes.
And this was operated mechanically through the wall of the cylinder. Well, you had to pull up, and it was quite a job. This thing was a stiff mechanism, and by the time a man had done this maybe 100 times a day, because 100 traps was a good thing, that was a good day's work.
Yeah.
And, of course, the lobsterman always was anxious to set more and more and more traps. Well, this was a tiresome, wearisome operation. So it was soon, men would say, for example, well, I wish I could go back to that little 3-horsepower Hartford I had in my first boat, because it started so easy. But then, of course, if I did go back to that, it would take me forever in this boat to ever get out to my traps. Everybody else would get there before I did.
Yeah.
It would be too slow, not power enough for her.
Yeah.
Well, the way to compromise then, since these engines did not slow down very well, that is the characteristic of the two-cycle engine, is that it doesn't throttle very well.
Mm-hmm.
It relies on its charge for using the crankcase as a pump, as a scavenger pump. And at slow speeds, it doesn't operate properly. It's the, it backfires and it loses power and so forth.
Yeah.
So the ingenuity worked out the scheme of having two engines, usually installed in the after third of the boat under a sliding hatch. These could be started by facing aft, opening the hatch, and started manually with the flywheel. Well, these engines would be side by side at just about the widest part of the boat. This would be her greatest beam at this point.
Yes, which could support
which could support them nicely. In fact, it could support very heavy weights, for that matter. And the rest of the boat, the forward part of the boat, was rather narrow, rather sharp entrance. Mm-hmm. And it was plenty big enough to carry fish, if they'd have fish boards across there, if they were hand lining or trawling.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as lobstering was concerned, of course, there was ample room for that. Well, the little engine, both engines would be used between home port and the beginning of the string of traps. And from that time on, the big engine would be shut off and the little engine would be started and would run the boat from one trap to the next one.
Yes.
And then if they had that string ended and another string was several miles away, it might justify the starting of both engines again. Of course, the three-engine stage took place not too long after that because this whole business of... you see, we're reaching all the time for more traps, and there's a limit to a man's strength. So hauling the traps by power was the next thing. How can I, if I haul more traps, this is a laborious job by hand, deeper water also, how can I haul them by power? Well, you couldn't hitch anything out of the driving engines because there was no way to keep the propeller from turning at the same time.
Yes.
See, they had no clutches, no reverse gears.
Yeah.
They were an engine that didn't operate properly this way anyhow. You couldn't use a clutch successfully on them. So the next step was to send usually to a mail order house like Sears Roebuck and buy a 1.5 or 2 horsepower stationary engine with a horizontal cylinder and 2 flywheels. These little engines could be bought for less than $100. And they were installed forward, about amidships, but forward of the engines. And they were belted usually. Sometimes they were chain-driven to a counter shaft. So there had to be some reduction gearing, of course, so you chain-drive to a counter shaft with a drum head on the end of it. And that engine would be that engine had a governor on it, which is operated on what they used to call the hit-and-miss principle. That is, there was a flyball governor on the flywheel, and when the engine had speeded up to the point where a centrifugal force caused these balls to fly apart, this would trip a part of the ignition mechanism so that the engine would simply misfire until it had slowed down again, and then the flyball governor would release this latch, and she'd begin to fire every turn again. Well, this took care of that engine, so it could be started up first thing in the morning, or when they got to the first trap, and it never had to be touched again. It ran continuously all day long, and it was always ready for the lobsterman to hook up his lobster warp, take two or three turns around the drum, and haul in the slack, and the engine would do the work.
Did he have a David out with a pulley on it?
Yes, they began to have Davids about that time, too, just as they do now.
Yeah.
Well, so then this meant that he had three engines in the boat. Of course, the next step was the coming of the automobile, and fishermen began to say, why not use the automobile engine, which will throttle down and declutch and use one engine in place of all three. And a great saving of gasoline, of course, because the four-cycle engine to begin with is more economical, but also a saving in complication of gear and room that it takes up,
and
too.
Weight also, actually.
Weight.
About what time did they begin using automobile engines?
Well, my guess is after the first World War. Let's say the automobile engines began coming in the 20s. Mm-hmm. I would say they did. Mm-hmm. If you've seen pictures of American expeditionary forces in France in the First World War, you'll realize that most of it was mule transportation.
Yes.
There were automobiles. The Dodge and Rio both made a command car, which mm-hmm. officers used, but as far as troops were concerned, they walked.
Mm-hmm.
Infantry did.
Even
World War II, there was quite a little of this. This was more or less due to the fact that, of course, the roads wouldn't stand up under military use anyhow, mm-hmm. so that it was you couldn't make a road that an automobile could run on.
Yeah.
And then, of course, automobiles weren't as reliable then, and the mass production couldn't build up quite as much as it has in this more recent wars.
Yeah.
But at any rate, these engines were taken out and were put in these boats. They were among the first, I won't say they were the first four-cycle engines used in work boats. They weren't.
Mm-hmm.
There were four-cycle engines that were made continuously with the two cycles from the very beginning.
Uh-huh.
The two principles were invented at roughly the same time, and the fishermen in the early no-service days, where you mail-ordered every engine and installed it yourself,
mm-hmm.
Of course, boat builders soon learned to install the engines, but it was a self-service thing, and the two-cycle engine lent itself to that beautifully, but
mm-hmm.
when they cars came along and garages began to be in the communities and mechanics began to be, local mechanics began to be aware of how you took care of a four-cycle engine, then it wasn't long before the fishermen began tumbling to them, and
mm-hmm.
they first began to use them with automobile transmissions, which were made over so that they could
mm-hmm.
be used with a boat. I can remember workboat engines, automobile engines, Model T Ford engines and Model A Ford engines, in which the fisherman had to step on a clutch before he could get into neutral.
Mm-hmm.
But usually they were welded, the gears were welded together in such a way that all it had was forward neutral and reverse.
Mm-hmm.
There were no other gears, no intermediate gears.
They cut out low in second.
Oh, yes, cut out low in second entirely. Because probably they would... Model T and Model A, too.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, it wasn't long before companies, seeing a market in this thing, began to adapt the automobile engine or convert them, as they do this day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've come to this, to the time when all there are converted automobile engines. We don't have anything else. Every marine engine is now basically an automotive engine that's been adapted to the purpose. Every one. There isn't a single 100% marine engine left. But there were, for many years, heavy-duty, slow-speed engines which were not too popular among the fishermen because they soon became interested in speed. Well, now, here's about the place where it gets to be a change of model.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as they began using greater powers, with the automobile engines, powers began to get up to such horrifying powers as 20, 25 horsepower, 30, 40, 50,
mm-hmm.
they began to creep up, bigger and bigger engines. Fishermen are like anybody else, they get a kick out of how there's a little rivalry, personal rivalry among fishermen as there is among farmers for equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And so more and more power. Well, now these round stern boats, they began to install the engine in a different place. In other words, they put the engine in amidships.
Mm-hmm.
Now the reason for this was that an engine installed far aft in a boat has to be installed at quite a steep pitch in order
yes.
to get the propeller down through into solid water.
Yes.
Well, now a two-cycle engine does not have oil, does not lubricate. It lubricates by putting oil in the gasoline.
Sure.
A four-cycle engine has to have oil in a sump. The result is no four-cycle engine can be installed at a steep pitch,
sure.
usually around 15 degrees with a four-cycle engine is about the maximum.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to install a four-cycle engine more nearly the middle of the boat.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Yeah.
Well, when they did this, one of the first things they realized was how nice it was to have an after deck on which you could pile traps.
Sure.
At the various times in the year when you move them from one place to another. Now, you notice this time of year the traps are all on the wharves.
Mm-hmm.
These square stern boats have ever so much more bearing aft to carry mm-hmm. traps. They'll carry a far greater load of traps than the old double-enders would.
Mm-hmm.
The double-enders would soon get down to the point where the exhaust pipe would be underwater, for example, which means they lose power and so on. So, and also, they got to be awfully dangerous as they were loaded down because it became top-heavy. There wasn't bearing enough aft.
Yes.
So that there were two motives that I suspect began to operate. The first thing was, as soon as they got the engines out of the stern, put them in the middle of the boat, they discovered right away what a nice that you could carry more traps aft.
Mm-hmm.
But then they found out that there was a limitation there because, in the first place, the boat didn't have as much room being pointed.
Yes.
In the second place, she didn't have bearing enough to carry a big high pilot trap. She was tippy.
Mm-hmm.
She was lost stiffness.
Yeah.
Then the other thing was they didn't improve this squatting business one bit.
Yes.
And as they put in larger powers, the boat squatted more and more.
Yeah.
They tended to duck, to drag their sterns down more and more. Well, they began, first of all, in Jonesport, and this you'll find out when you go down there. The Jonesport builders developed some very interesting variations. First of all, there's a sort of a shovel tail thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a boat with a transom stern, but the transom, instead of being more or less upright, sloped back. Now, whether they got this from the shape of early destroyers or fast yachts, I don't know.
When you say sloped back, you mean the forward end of it is further forward.
Further forward than the aft end.
Tumble home.
Yeah, they tumbled home forward.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose the purpose of this, of course, was to give them they were longer on the waterline than they were on top, in a way. At least they were aft, whatever the bow did.
Yeah. Since they gave a square transom, this squared them off and gave them bearing right there.
Right, it gave them bearing right there. But they thought at first, for some reason or other, that this raking it aft made it more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
All I can see that it would do would be to keep some weight out of the boat back there, because there wasn't any boat.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it took them quite a while to go through this, and I can remember that persisted long after they were convinced that it really didn't make much difference anymore. Simply because of what we were speaking of, conservatism, this is the way a Jonesport boat looks, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It's how you can tell it's a Jonesport boat, is because it has that kind of a stern.
Yeah, even their double-enders had a tumble-home stem post.
Lots of them did,
Yeah.
And they do in Norway to this day, in Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
Sweden, they have, they're still double-enders with a tumble back to the stern stem. It'll
may
tumble back inward. And it's more of a style than anything else.
Yes.
They're conservative,
too.
The Dutch do this, sure they do. In fact, the Swedes probably copied the Dutch. Because the Dutch are an older culture in that respect.
Well, you know, there is an analogy, I suppose, to the Novi boat, which also has a tumble home.
Right,
And also, even up in Prince Edward Island, Bordeaux's Dairy has got a calendar just sent out this winter.
Is that so?
And has a picture of some boats on PEI.
Yeah.
And they look like a Novi boat.
Yeah.
They really do, with that tumble home transom.
Well, I'll be damned.
Very interesting.
Well, at any rate, you'll find plenty of those. In fact, there was another form of it which was rounded as well as sloping backward like this. There were steel boats by a manufacturing concern called Mullins out west that partly responsible for. They call it a duck foot stern.
Duck foot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But if you look at, for instance, there's a Herreshoff's book that he wrote about his father, a book called Captain Nat, which has a great many pictures of the boats that the Herreshoff Manufacturing Company built and his father designed. There was a boat called Nao Huan, a fast steam yacht around 120 feet long and quite narrow in the style of the time. It had a stern like that, and he comments that his father only designed one like this because on the trial trip, Mrs. Herreshoff was invited to go along with the owner's wife, because the Herreshoffs were very socially acceptable people.
Mm-hmm.
And in backing out of the slip, there was a little swell that came along or something, and it scooped her lap full of water or something,
oh,
and the ladies were drenched.
Oh.
by the fact that as she backed out, probably they backed out fast. They were showing off, you see.
Yeah.
And they backed out fast, and probably had shoveled this, scooped it right up, as you'd expect it to do.
Yes.
But Jonesport may have copied this type of thing, which was commoner in yachts, fast yachts, than it was in workboats. Now, who knows? They saw pictures, maybe?
Yes.
And they thought maybe this device would be good to keep a boat from squatting. If it was good for a fast yacht, it would be good for a fast fisherman.
Yes. I suppose they saw publications such as what?
Sure they did.
Fore and Aft and
Rudder. Rudder, probably. Right. About the only thing, yeah. Fore and Aft would be, Billy Atkins magazine would be short-lived later. I don't think that the fishermen would see that. The old Motor Boat magazine was not quite contemporaneous, but I would say that was the next oldest one to Rudder.
Yes.
Rudder started in 1890 as a separate publication. It was run in conjunction with the Oarsman and with Field and Stream and various other magazines before that, but it became independent about 1890. Well, at any rate, fishermen may have seen pictures, or they may have actually seen yachts, because by this time, fishermen were, in the wintertime, were surprisingly mobile. Mm-hmm. I have seen Maine Coast fishermen in Boston in the middle of the winter. They traveled by steamboat, and they got around. They saw things.
Mm-hmm.
And also,
the more and more of the summer people...
Summer people began
coming up.
That's
in
right,
the 1880s,
sure.
Didn't they?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And they saw these yachts, and they were impressed with them. It looks to me as if that kind of a stern wouldn't squat. Maybe they saw them underway and saw that they didn't squat.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, I think the desire for speed and the desire for carrying weight, lobster traps, at the seasons of the year when they have to take them in and take them out again.
Yeah.
Fewer trips, of course, and it's a job that they don't like to do anyhow and get it over with. I'd say those two motives were inseparable. I don't know which ruled. Because it is a fact that you can get more speed out of a square stern boat than you can out. Now, you see, mine's a double ender, my Morning Star out there, you see. That one with a buff top.
Yes.
That's a Monterey boat.
Yes.
She's a West Coast boat.
Mm-hmm.
But she's a double ender, and the reason I had her built was because I've always liked double enders. They had them when I was a kid, and they're a very easily driven model at low speeds, up to about 6 knots. They go very easily, very little power. Now, this boat only uses 1.5 gallons of gasoline an hour, which for a boat as big as that is very little.
Yes. Is that a roundish?
No, it's pretty much the same shape as the...
Oh, yes, I see it.
Sometimes the stern post is a little more raked than that one is. That's kind of snubby.
Yes, I see.
But, that's a regular double end. And as far as I know, she's the only double end powerboat on the Maine coast now, except for coast double enders that were formerly lifeboats, you know, that kind of thing.
There used to be a double ended Jones Porter around here, and someone told me that it's possible that she's hauled up in Cranberry now.
Oh, really?
She's gray.
A
colored one, and she's a tumble home stern boat.
Well, that would be good to see, yes.
I'd like to locate that.
Just a little while ago, let's see, 5 or 6 years ago, I was down at Bristol, South Bristol. I was down at South Bristol, and I saw two little launches. They were both summer launches. Looked very old indeed. That had those tumbled home round stems, tumbled home transom. Yeah, that was the style. It was at one time. It was. I don't know just what you'd where that tumble home feature came from, but it may have been the idea that you needed waterline length aft in order to give bearing to hold that thing up when
because
you're putting in power.
Oh, actually, to give it the idea of length as opposed to width.
Yeah, that's the idea. Yeah. Well, at any rate, now I think this is more or less of the story as far as this change of shape goes. Now, ever since these boats straightened out as square stern boats, these work boats, there has been almost no change. Mm-hmm. Almost no change. The only change there has been is bigger boats and especially wider boats.
Mm-hmm.
They've been getting much wider in recent years. You've been getting boats 36 feet long and sometimes as much as 12-foot beam.
Yes.
And This is because the engines have been getting so much more powerful, especially the few that are putting in diesel engines. But even if you look at the advertisements of marine engines in, well, the National Fisherman, for example, mm-hmm. you'll notice that under 215, 16 horsepower, they're almost unobtainable.
Yeah.
There aren't any small engines anymore. Mm-hmm. There are all these great big things. The V8s are the most popular thing right now.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, sixes were popular. Then now they've gone into V8s because I suppose they take up less room.
Mm-hmm.
But a V8 200 horsepower is about as small as they get, and they go up from there up to over 400.
Yeah, oh my word.
And you see, they're awful gas hogs. I suppose I thought they'd last forever, but there's the picture I referred to, a Monhegan Friendship sloop, and you see, that probably is in the 20s.
Mm-hmm. I found that there are some men who specialize in making those sails still. There are some.
Well, more or less, yes. Although the sail is cut, it can be made by an awning maker or anybody, because they're not. There's no cut to them.
Yeah.
They're absolutely flat. They're not like a sail that's made for propulsion purposes.
Yes.
They're not like a real yacht sail. They're just flat. They're just bound around the edge. They may just seem to tarpaulin is made exactly.
Mm-hmm.
See, so anybody can make one of those sails.
Yeah.
That don't really amount to much. They have become less and less. They seem to be used less and less all the time. And whether this boat builder might be a good man to ask, a fellow who builds, that's a new Friendship sloop
yes,
there.
Yes, I've seen this. In
you've seen this one,
yeah.
I don't know whether there's any reason in the shape of the boat underwater. I'm not prepared to say. Some boat builder might give you an idea that I don't know. If anything, I would say that the boats have been cut away shorter and shorter and shorter underwater all the time. In other words, the propeller is now tucked back under the boat further than it used to be.
Yes.
Now, this is for the sake of making them turn quickly, of course.
Yes.
It's the whole idea is they have a big flat, the under part of the stern is extremely flat.
Mm-hmm.
And on lobster boats, that flat section is longer than it is on a boat such as you saw, yacht such as you saw Bobby building up there.
Mm-hmm.
That's a modified lobster boat design, but the modification is pretty extensive.
Yeah.
But usually in a lobster boat, the after, well, you might almost call it the after overhang, but at mm-hmm. least the flat section of the boat is quite long.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, turns very easily as
yes.
she... You probably know that the turning of any boat, the bow stays there, but the stern is the part that moves,
mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
see. That's the way she turns. Is by this. It's like an automobile that's steering by the back wheels.
Mm-hmm,
and so that by making them flat there and giving them very little lateral plane aft, they turn much more easily.
Mm-hmm. Scuff around.
Yeah, scuff around very easily. So this is the reason for that, and it may be... It may be that this has gone far enough now so that it is not so necessary as it used to be to force the boat to lie with her bow to the wind on what you might call the weather vane principle.
Mm-hmm.
That is, having
mm-hmm.
something aft that will
yes.
keep pushing her stern around and letting her bow
and
stay
out.
The
stern is so flat now.
Maybe the stern is so flat now.
She just blows around anyway.
Yeah.
It
tends to stay that way anyway. Now,
mm-hmm.
and the bow... of course, has more grip on the water. The V-sections are forward, you see. They start
yes.
out V-section. As you go aft, you probably notice this. They get flatter and flatter.
Yeah.
Well, now, the old-style boat never was this way, but these are.
Mm-hmm.
And
keep,
ever since they've been...
flattened in the center and then V again aft.
Yeah. They would be this way, as a Peapod would be.
Mm-hmm.
Or a Whitehall boat, for that matter. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're going to make an easily driven boat at slow speeds, you want a boat that's V'd at both ends.
Yes.
That flat stern thing is a great power waster.
Mm-hmm.
It is now just as it was then.
Mm-hmm.
Still is a power waster.
Yeah, as and, in any design of this kind, you have to give up something for something
right,
else.
Right, right. The old Emersonian principle of adjustments.
Yes.
And you do.
Can you give me a reference on that principle of adjustments?
Now wait a minute. I wish I could, because I have I can find it for you.
I'd
I'm
like
quite
to know.
Sure. I can find that. I can find a statement of that somewhere. And if you'll wait just a second, I'll see if I can go and get the thing. I can find it. Is it Frank Semple? It's something that he wrote in here, and I can find that, by gosh. And I'm going to get your address before you go, and I'll run across this sooner or later, and I'll get in touch with you and let you know where that is. But I can't, when I'm in a hurry, I usually can't find these things.
Yeah.
But Semple, who is about the only manufacturer of steam launch machinery there is in the country now.
Mm-hmm.
He is a curator of Transportation Museum in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
I've always wanted to see it. And he has a summer place up on Keyser Lake in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And he operates, he's got a little steamboat that he operates up there, steam launch. And he's an engineering graduate, of course, and has been an engineering professor one time or another. And I think it's something he wrote in here that called attention to this. He was the fact that he was comparing internal combustion and steam, and the point being that when you move from one medium to the other, there are gains and losses that compensate for one another. High speed and slow speed has certain gains, high speed has certain gains, but each in moving from one toward the other, you lose something in the process. And of course, this is all arts and crafts, I suppose, fall under this same heading. The historical changes, I suppose. A friend of mine was in here the other day, who's a environmental scientist on the electrical side, and who's making studies of atmospheric electrical potentials, difference in potential. I've seen since I was a youngster. We were in sea scouting together when I was young. But he dropped in here the other day, and we were talking about the spiritual aspects of some of these scientific things. And he was saying that all nature is attempting, forever attempting to come to an equipoise. And as a result, it swings between extremes. This is the kind of thing that's going on now in our social ferment in this country, that we humans, of course, are part of nature, a very peculiar and a distinctive part of nature, but at the same time they follow the general principles of the thing. And here we're swinging now through radical groups that are attempting to force action without taking personal responsibility. We swing in one direction, and this discharges itself almost always in violence. And in the very discharge in violence, you come back closer to the middle, because those who have been involved in the discharge have lost something in the discharge themselves. It's just like an electric potential. They have, we have a statement, they've gotten it off their chest, somebody says, you know. I've spoken my mind to somebody that I've had a confrontation with. I spoke my mind and I felt better. I got it off my chest. My aggressiveness, my innate desire to express myself and to put over a portion of my what I have to give. I've done it. Now I am replenished. I'm depleted to a certain extent, and I can rest for a while in my accomplishment.
A biologist, I think, would call it a homeostatic mechanism.
Yes,
almost.
Yes, I think perhaps they would.
On a species level, at least.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is very old social philosophy, I think, probably going back to the Greeks.
Yes, I imagine it does.
With their concern for moderation,
which
would apply poles.
Yeah, yeah.
You see.
Polarities and finding a coming to rest. It isn't that, the curious thing about it is that it doesn't necessarily satisfy us that we accomplish the social ends that we set out to accomplish, but we have expressed ourselves. We've just had as a house guest a cousin of my wife's, who is a very well-to-do woman indeed, she's been in it for years in a social ferment. She goes on all these marches and protests, pickets places, and so on. And this is a very great thing in her life, although she comes from a milieu, from a climate, social climate, which has no unsatisfied needs for itself, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But for some reason or other, she's a compulsive protester. And it's kind of laughable to some extent, because she showed us the boots she had bought to go in the smartarium. Bolts, except that I could always... Until recently, I could recognize a Jonesport boat when I saw it, but the differences have become less as the time has gone on.
So when was the time when the Jonesport boat was distinctly recognizable? Was it about 15
I'd
years
say
ago?
20 to 35,
mm-hmm.
somewhere in there.
Yes.
I'd say that about not too awfully many years. It might have gone back before 1920, but I don't think so, because the Jonesport boat became distinctive in the era when powers were increasing.
Mm-hmm.
More and more powerful engines were becoming available
mm-hmm.
for fishermen to use. They've always been great people to race their lobster boats, and of course they have a summer festival now
mm-hmm.
designed to, they're making use of this proclivity in order to attract tourists.
You said they've always been more interested.
But they've always been interested in racing.
Ever since they, is this more so than the people around here?
Yes, all Swan's Island is another place where they've been interested in having fast work boats
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and been interested in racing them. I once went out there when I stopped on a cruise when I was cruising in a sailboat once, and I tried to buy some milk.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no milk available. And I said, what, no cows here? You got lots of room for cows. And my informant, the storekeeper, said, these fellows are too, they spend all their time when they're not fishing, racing their boats. He says, they come in and you can hear them in the afternoon. They're too busy to keep a cow. They haven't got time enough to keep a cow or have a vegetable garden.
Mm-hmm.
They're too interested in racing boats, you see.
They're
so
awfully expensive.
People around here, I think Ralph Benson might comment on the fact
mm-hmm.
that if speed was a real interest among them, it would stimulate experimental boat building, you see. They'd go to boat builders often, the lobstermen would, and they'd say, I want a boat that can beat so-and-so's boat.
Mm-hmm.
I want a boat that I can put a really big engine in and really go step out with it. And the boat builder would be a student of his craft, and he'd be a follower also of the demands.
Yes.
And so I think that... This speed business was most, as far as the Jonesport boats were concerned, was certainly very suggestive. Now, of course, an old Jonesport boat builder, if you could locate some fella that had a retired boat builder, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
he might give you an additional motivation or suggest an additional information that I couldn't, because
mm-hmm.
I know almost nothing about. I've been through Moosebeck Reach, but I've never been to Jonesport, really. I've never been to shore in Jonesport.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. But the Jonesport boat, for many years, had a distinctive outline. Now, the high bow might possibly be a sort of a bridge between the high bow of the Cape, so-called Cape model, Nova Scotia fishermen,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
And of course the St. Pierre Dory.
Yes.
Such high bow boats as you discover down east. There may be a bridge between that and the more moderate profiles as far as shear is concerned
mm-hmm.
in the rest of this country in the Jonesport boat, which was a boat with a rather high bow, It had quite a distinctive profile for a long time. It was narrow and sharp forward, I would say, and broadened out to one of these shovel sterns.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the best places to get an instant appreciation of the distinctiveness of the old Jonesport boat is that roadside sign that you see advertising Jonesport as a tourist attraction.
Yeah.
It's a big wooden sign. There are a number of them along the roads between mm-hmm. here and Portland, in which there's a picture of a Jonesport boat. It was characteristic of the sign. Now, that,
mm-hmm.
that Jonesport boat, except for the fact that it has a modern, conventional, up-and-down transom stern, has that sweeping, long, sweeping bow shear, and the shape of the bow, too, is quite characteristic of them. Rather more overhang than our boats have here.
Yes.
And a rather more of a continuous curve in the bow. There are no flat places in it. Ours,
mm-hmm.
most of our bows here start out as a straight line, the stem does, and
yes.
then it begins to curve further down.
Yeah.
Now, you notice on the Jonesport stem, it's a continuous curve the whole way.
Mm-hmm.
And that, combined with the shear starts, I'd say, either amidships or a little aft of amidships,
mm-hmm.
before it begins to spring upward like that.
Yes.
And once it starts, it keeps right on going.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that she's low. Now, you can see the low freeboard is a characteristic that a lobster boat should have, no matter where she is,
mm-hmm.
simply because you don't want to lift the trap out of water. As long as it's waterborne, it comes pretty easily.
Yeah.
But the last part of it, lifting, even with power, of course, with power hoisting, it's not going to be as great a reason as we used to have for keeping the freeboard low.
Mm-hmm.
But it still persists that a lobster boat ought not to be too high.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, perhaps last summer you remember when there was a fiberglass lobster boat made by Weber's Cove.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was made on... adapted from the lines of a Navy launch
mm-hmm.
that they built perhaps during the war, maybe even since. But at any rate, they have taken this, and they're still making these fiberglass hulls around 34 feet and advertising them for both to be finished, both as pleasure boats and work boats. Well, now, I remember hearing lobstermen down at the wharf commenting on that boat,
mm-hmm.
which was there for everyone to see. How do you like it? Well, they'd say, I think she's too high.
Yeah.
Now, actually, especially with these hydraulic pothaulers,
mm-hmm.
there really isn't too much reason why freeboard is affected one way or another, because these are quite capable of hauling at 20 feet high if they
yeah.
wanted to. But the same persistence operates here.
Yes.
Keep the freeboard down, because your trap will be waterborne furthest. It makes
yeah.
it easier
yeah.
if you don't have to lift it too far,
mm-hmm.
see?
Mm-hmm.
So that this persists, even though perhaps mechanically there's no reason for it anymore. Lobstermen are still talking about, let's not have a boat too high.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you look out at these boats in the harbor here, you see that there's not much experiment that's gone on in freeboard.
Mm-hmm.
It's all just about the same. The
mm-hmm.
bigger boats seem to have a little more freeboard, but then, of course, they're the boats that go the furthest to sea,
mm-hmm.
and the fellows who are tough and fishing all winter, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
very good. I just noticed here that this steam launch...
Yeah. Well, she's really
identical.
Not a steam launch. She's
yeah.
a gas launch, but...
Yes.
But
she is identical in hull form to this Merle Black's boat over here.
Yes, exactly.
Sorry,
that's right. There. That's right. Yeah. And I had... I owned one smaller than this at one time, which I bought when I was in Ellsworth. Bought it for $5. Found her in a field with grass growing in her. And I'll show you a picture of her presently.
Yeah.
She is that same type of stern. These were very, very common indeed.
Mm-hmm. What would you call that stern?
Well,
fantail
stern? Around, a fantail or a round stern, yeah. fantail stern. It's a difficult stern to build, but the reason that these boats had it is the same reason that they used to dress little boys and girls. at that period in miniature adult clothes.
Mm-hmm.
The little girls in the Civil War period, for instance, look just like their mothers, and they're mm-hmm. 5 years old. Mm-hmm. First. And the little boys, the same way. They wore Civil War soldiers' caps, little mm-hmm. forage caps,
yeah,
for years and years. And boats, these were copied after the steamboat styles.
Hmm, you see? Yes, sure.
And the little boats were supposed to resemble the big boats, just the same as little men and women were supposed to represent big, to resemble the big ones. And mm-hmm. the style was copied from, it seemed to be a, well, they couldn't do it very well with, well, yes, baby carriages. Baby carriages looked like surreys with a fringe on top, you remember?
Oh, darn, yes.
So I think there was a definite thing there. And these boats, they were built very much like the steamboats, like small steamboats of the
mm-hmm.
day.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a half cabin launch. Now, they had full cabin launches that were completely enclosed.
Mm-hmm.
And these windows were drop sash windows. See, the windows are all open now,
yeah,
but they
yeah.
were drop sash windows that came up.
Mm-hmm.
And you could completely enclose the cockpit of some of these boats. Just as the early steamboats. Now, mm-hmm. I have a scrapbook of steamboats that shows the evolution from steamboat to steam launch as far as design ideology is concerned. It's quite remarkable. I'll show you some pictures of those. But
the Reverend Malcolm McDuffie, January 15th, 1970, end of interview.